This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Oru Kayak. They design folding kayaks that can go virtually anywhere, thanks to their lightweight and folding design. Stay tuned for later in the episode. We'll talk to van lifer Brianna Media about how she stores two kayaks in her van. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting.
This is Annalee Flynn reading Wild Geese by Mary Oliver.
You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.
It's so good, it kills me.
This is a deeply personal episode about mental health and the outdoors. For that reason, I believe it's better suited to adults, but I'll let parents make that decision for themselves. I also want to say that I am by no means a professional or able to offer medical advice. So if you're feeling suicidal or like you need to talk to someone, please call 1-800-273-TALK. I asked listeners to submit their experiences with mental health and received vulnerable stories about depression, anxiety, addiction, and trauma.
Mental health can feel like smoke that you just can't grasp, like a dark cloud hanging over you, and you can't see it or touch it, but you can feel it.
A common thread through all of the voice memos is that for these women, spending time outside isn't the only therapy, but it is therapeutic.
When I'm outdoors, I'm seeing, I'm feeling, I'm touching real and tangible things, and I'm seeing the beauty of life instead of the negativity of my own inward life. And it feels good.
I like to think of this podcast as a safe space, as a no-judgment zone of sorts. So I hope you'll listen with compassion. I hope also, if you're struggling, you'll know that you're not alone. And if it's any consolation, I've been there too. For the first part of this episode, I talked with Florence Williams, the author of The Nature Fix. It's a really fascinating nonfiction book that takes the almost universal notion that the outdoors is good for our health and well-being and tests it out. I love the idea of substantiating the benefits of spending time outside. We focused our discussion around mental health.
I had been fortunate enough to live in the Rocky Mountains in these really idyllic towns for 2 decades. And then my husband took a job in Washington, D.C. And so we moved about 4 years ago. And I just felt like this sort of cortisol bomb, like the stress bomb went off in my brain. When I moved here, there was terrible traffic, tons of noise pollution, this really monochromatic cityscape. And I was depressed and I was anxious and I would just burst into tears in the traffic circles. And I started just to think about what I had lost in terms of my almost hourly connection to nature that I had been so fortunate to have. And it just got me thinking about environmental psychology, the importance of place. And I was curious, as a science journalist, I was curious, you know, what the science was actually saying about this. Where was the evidence? Was it possible to actually measure physiological changes in different environments?
Why do you think it's so important to back up the feeling that the outdoors might be good for your health and your mental health with research, with actual data?
Well, I don't think it is for everyone. You know, I think a lot of us just know intuitively that it makes us feel good. But what I also learned is that a lot of us don't know it. there have been some really interesting studies showing that people actually undervalue the benefits of nature. For example, a researcher in Canada had people predict how sort of happy they would feel after a walk across campus through trees and grass. And then she had another group take the tunnels, like these underground tunnels, and people really misinterpreted how they would feel in each of those walks. And it turns out they did feel a lot better after being outside, but they misforecast that experience. Also, we're just living in an age where many of us are so cut off from nature because we don't spend time outside. We don't think of it as kind of an intervention, for example, when we're feeling bad. We tend to think things like Netflix or ice cream will improve our mood, and, you know, and they will for a little while. And then, you know, the other piece is that we live in a really evidence-based society. So if we want these kinds of ideas, you know, to really infiltrate into things like schools and neighborhoods and institutions and city planning, the medical community, you know, they really want the evidence.
You know, we often hear about how spending time outside is beneficial for our mental health, but we don't hear as much about how not spending time outside is detrimental. Can you speak to your experience with that?
You know, I just felt like I was really missing something. I was really missing that daily connection or hourly connection to nature. I began to read, you know, more about what the journalist Richard Louv calls nature deficit disorder. And he really largely applied it to children because they are so cut off in general, much more so than any other generation before them. Kids growing up today. And, you know, of course, he pointed out these sort of epidemics that we're seeing in children and in adults, and obesity, anxiety, depression, things like even myopia, vitamin D deficiencies. All of these things are chronic and epidemic, and they're really linked to time indoors, it turns out. And of course, now we have technology, which further provides these amazing entertainments and allure farther indoors. Like in the 70s and the 80s, when I was growing up, kids were bored if they spent time inside. All they had inside was like television, and some of that was bad, you know, and even we knew it. And so we used to like go out and play with our friends. But now there's like this world of perfectly fulfilling entertainments inside your technology devices. And then I think there's also fear. Your parents don't want their kids roaming around outside. And because there aren't a lot of kids outside, then it feels even less safe. So it kind of builds on itself, unfortunately.
You had a lot of funny moments in the book. And this is kind of funny, but kind of not funny. You wrote that the Japanese word for stress is stress. Are there any ways that you feel like anxiety is like unique to the Western world?
I mean, leave it to the Americans to export the word stress. America is this land of possibility, right, which is a beautiful thing. But it also means there's a tremendous drive and a tremendous ambition. And, you know, you can get ahead, but you really have to work hard. And then we industrialized so intensively. And then we exported that idea to other parts of the world. So in Japan, for example, I mean, Japan industrialized incredibly quickly, you know, really right after World War II. Tokyo grew these incredible skyscrapers and this economy, and it's like booming, booming, booming. And yet they also have this incredible epidemic of overwork and work-related stress, people literally dropping dead at their desks. There's a word for it in Japan, karoshi. There's a culture there that took the American idea and then even put it on steroids.
I asked Florence about forest bathing, something she experienced with the Japanese while researching the book. It's almost like an antidote to all of that stress that she talks about.
So forest bathing in Japan, it's called Shinrin Yoku. And it was really this idea promoted by the Japanese Forest Agency as a way to get urban stressed out people, you know, to unwind and to encourage them to go to these forest, what they call forest therapy trails, not too far outside of Tokyo, and open up all five senses to the forest around them. It's just a way to be really mindful in the space. And then scientists there measured what happens to people after doing this for 20 minutes, where they're really trying to pay attention to the birds and the feeling the moss under their feet. It's a kind of skill to really be so mindful in a place that they really cultivated. And what the scientists have measured, that their blood pressure drops, their sense of well-being increases, their heart rate variability changes, their stress hormones change for the better. Even just 15 or 20 minutes of doing this, it's kind of a shortcut to really feeling better.
You quoted, and I probably am going to pronounce his name wrong, Paul Atchley, as saying tech is leading us in a negative direction and nature may prevent that. He was speaking to that, especially as it relates to attention. How are our brains benefited from attention to one task in nature?
Paul Atchley is a psychologist who specializes in attention and the attention network. And he actually often writes about things like distracted driving. If you're talking on a cell phone, you're not really seeing what's in front of you in the road. And this has actually been proven in a lot of really intriguing studies. He's so focused on the limits of our attention network. We can't really do two things at once. And so in our normal daily lives, our attentional networks are so on alert all the time. So much information is coming at us so quickly, partly from technology, but also just partly from the demands of our office lives or our work lives or our family lives. And that attentional network didn't really evolve, you know, to handle that same level of stimulation all the time. We evolved in these more sort of extended family networks where a lot of work was shared. Maybe something would alert our fear system, like a snake in front of us, but it, you know, they're not like 100 snakes. And so there was just more opportunity for those kind of attentional networks to take a break or take in information at a more relaxed pace than we do in modern life. And so what Paul Atchley has found is that when we go outside in nature, the pace of life is just quieter and slower, in some ways more in line with the way our nervous systems evolved to process and intake information. And so there's something that happens that kind of relaxes us because we're not so hypervigilant all the time like we are in everyday life here.
With the technology and the phone, it's this weird mix of being on alert, stress reaction, and then also this brain reward reaction for checking and getting that little dopamine hit, the email that you got or the like that you got on Facebook. It's a really odd feeling and it really catches up to you over time.
Well, and we feel like we have to react to everything right away. So we're constantly reacting, as opposed to when we're on a hike or when we're on a walk, our sort of daydreaming parts of our brain, our default network, instead of our attention network, is able to kick in. And that's where we can do sort of deeper thinking.
That uninterrupted thinking time is really valuable.
Especially, you know, if we're dealing with kind of big issues in our lives. Paul Atchley and his colleague David Strayer talk about something called the three-day effect. It really kicks in after about 3 days of being in the wilderness that we start to just see the world in sort of a different way. We start to notice things we wouldn't have otherwise noticed. And that default network just really takes off. And that's when we need to perhaps deal with recovering from grief or recovering from trauma. You know, we're able to do that when we're outside.
I'll share two listener stories with you that relate to this concept after a quick word from our sponsor, Oru Kayak. The folks at Oru Kayak believe that connecting to nature is a deep human need. I talked with Brianna Media, who works full-time near Salt Lake City and also happens to live in a van with her husband.
My husband and I and our two dogs, we live in our van. It's a 1990 E350, so it's kind of smaller in scale in terms of storage space. So we keep a lot of stuff on the roof. And we had always wanted kayaks, but finding a place to store a kayak when you live in a van is a real challenge. And so when we had heard that there were these kayaks that fold up to a reasonable size, we were super stoked. And we keep them either strapped to our roof rack, or we can actually shove them under the storage area under the back of our bed as well. Pretty soon, the van is going to be sort of like cartoony looking, I feel like, with all of the stuff. Two kayaks stacked on top, like strapped to the side of a mountain bike with like a snowboard. So yeah, it'll be quite interesting. But yeah, the foldable kayaks was a major game changer because we were like, this is actually possible now.
Make room in your life and get on the water in a beautiful, foldable Oru kayak. Learn more at www.orukayak.com. That's www.orukayak.com.
Recovering from grief or recovering from trauma, you know, we're able to do that when we're outside.
In July of 2015, I got in my car and I drove from Los Angeles to the Grand Canyon and then to Zion and then to Bryce. And I spent 2 weeks by myself in my car, and when not driving, I was by myself in a tent or on a trail, exploring somewhere I'd never been and trying to get over the heartbreak of having an abortion 7 months earlier. I was 30 when I got pregnant unexpectedly and never thought that I would find myself in the position where I might need to have an abortion. It was devastating, and I found peace and freedom and sadness and a lot of relief. The last night in Bryce, I wrote a letter. This sounds so dramatic, but I wrote a letter to my could-be child and explained to her or him what happened, and I burned it in the campfire, and it was one of the most cathartic, touching moments of my life. I don't think that I would have done this if I had not been in a safe place, which was outside, surrounded by darkness and wilderness, and having had 2 weeks to be by myself and come to peace, which is what I was able to do.
I think I've spent most of my adult life dealing with depression and anxiety and addiction. In the last two and a half years, I have been experimenting with sobriety. When I first decided to get sober, I was in Maine, my home state and the place where I live now. And I started swimming every day in the ocean, sometimes in the lake. Being outside, swimming, hiking, taking a walk in the woods has been such an important part of my recovery and coming to terms with myself, my mental health. It's been a long winter in Maine, as it always is, and most days I go out walking in the mud or in the icy, slushy snow. I'm still dealing with these things. Depression, anxiety, it comes and goes. I have 6 months of sobriety that I'm very proud of and I feel very grateful for. I honestly don't know what I would do. I would never underestimate the importance of therapy, counseling, medications for some people who really need them. But it's just as important to me to be outside.
I wrapped up my conversation with Florence by asking her how we can best incorporate nature into our busy lives.
Looks like from the science that there is a dose curve for nature and that the more the better, and that's true of more time in nature the better, and also the more naturey the better, the more biodiversity, for example. So while it's great to get as much city and urban nature as you can while you're in the city, it's also important, I think, sometimes if you can, to seek out less human influenced landscapes. So to go to forests where you're not going to hear the sounds of humankind, where you can hear those birds more clearly, and to go to the wilderness areas, if you can, once a year, once every couple of years, when you have like big issues in your lives that you want to deal with.
You can find Florence's book, The Nature Fix, on Amazon and our episode page. I found it absolutely fascinating, and it made me want to drop everything and go outside. For this episode, I also chose to talk with Sonia Pevsner, a young woman who is blogging about her depression and anxiety, as well as its intersection with her love of spending time outside. I appreciate her open demeanor and her self-awareness about how she feels and how it affects herself and others.
Anxiety feels like you're standing on top of a cliff and you're about to go cliff jumping. And so you're clipped into your harness and you're like about to jump. And then at the last minute, you remember that you might not have secured all of your harness properly and that you might fall to your death. You're like 99% certain that you secured the harness. There's like that little seed of doubt. And then like right before you're about to jump, you're like, oh my God, I could die. That's what anxiety feels like. But you're, you know, like sitting on the couch thinking about something you have to do, or wondering about something you have to do, or even like you're going into work or you're traveling. Anything that you're doing when you're anxious about it is just horribly exacerbated. And even though like you know you did everything right, like you locked the door, you turned the stove off, you nailed the interview, you know there's nothing to actually worry about. Or like if you objectively look at it, you know that there's little cause for anxiety, but your mind turns it into this like life or death situation. And it's so hard to be objective when you are in that space.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
In your email, you had mentioned that you struggle with some of the same stuff that I do, or similar anxiety. So I wonder if my experience with anxiety is similar to other people's. I want to do a good job of explaining it for people who don't really understand, but I wonder what it, like, does it sound familiar for you?
Yeah, I think, at least hearing you talk about it, I think that it does manifest in different ways for different people. I think for me, it does manifest in worry, and that worry often leads to inaction and saying no to maybe a social commitment that I had been excited about, and just coming up with all these reasons not to do it, or feeling really nervous before the social commitment and then going and having it be fine. I also have a tendency to not acknowledge things and then to have it manifest like on my skin instead. So like I've been having a lot of like rosacea flare-ups recently. I think I tend to ask other people questions in order to not deflect, but to learn. So I was totally deflecting there. Notice how high my voice got. Sonia caught me off guard. I don't like talking about myself. Depression and anxiety run in my family, and it's no one's fault, but I was taught to keep it in. For me, it's a little like a sine curve. Do you remember that from trigonometry? It's a line that goes up and down, like a wave, highs and lows. My highs aren't too high, nor are my lows, all things considered. But I'm old enough to know that I will feel a certain way again. If I'm upset or sad, I know it will pass, and I know it will return. I'm also old enough to know that it's okay to talk about. I've found that if I'm depressed or anxious, two things really help me: communicating and breathing. But I also love to walk and hike. The busier my mind, the better it feels when I'm outside and in motion. Why did you decide to talk about anxiety and depression on your blog?
Because I was looking for something that I needed and I couldn't find it. I was looking for candid advice for people struggling with depression. And a lot of the advice you see is very, there's this whole subset of the internet culture that's like,
Pinterest focused, or like, you know, go for a walk or take a bath or like buy something pretty. And the rest of the advice is like get a therapist and like, you know, self-help books. And I didn't really see a lot of, there wasn't a lot in the middle. And that's what I needed, and I couldn't find it. So I think I created it to fill that void because I felt like I could offer that perspective and like how I was dealing with it.
That notion that Sonia alluded to earlier, that there are many different ways to experience anxiety, ring true in the voice memos that I received. Haley Hirsch shares her experience.
For the past 4 years, I have suffered from anxiety. It manifests in different ways, like fear of failure and social anxiety, but the biggest thing for me has been health anxiety, which most people know as hypochondria. It started after college with a skin cancer scare, and then with the stress of work and relationships in young adulthood, it has come and gone, but remained pretty present in my life. Anxiety is a constant battle of self-monitoring, identifying and challenging negative thoughts, and taking care of myself. One of the best things that I found, though, is staying active and being outside. Being active on the trail or elsewhere reassures me of the physical strength of my body. I think more clearly when I'm outside, too. When I'm out in the world, physical survival is higher on the list than worrying if I might have skin cancer. And when I spend time practicing yoga or sleeping in a tent under a sky full of stars, I feel tapped into the bigger picture, and that helps me zoom out and see my life in perspective. Connecting with the earth reminds me also that failure, as I fear it, is a human construct. It soothes my anxiety to spend time outdoors because nature doesn't care about my resume or how much I got done today. It doesn't judge me for how slowly I'm moving. It doesn't overthink its purpose or lifespan. It just is. And it feels good just to be.
And Natalie Martinez is a small business owner and a creative. So her story in particular resonated with me.
That growl is my connection to the outdoors. That is Willow, my dog. I've been an independent photographer and designer for almost 6 years now, and I would definitely say the outdoors keeps me sane. It connects me back to where I need to be, and Willow does that too by actually getting me outside. She doesn't have the guilt issues that I do in terms of the constant hustle of being productive and creative and producing enough to pay the bills and put food on the table. Her needs are met because I have her back. But she reminds me to get my own needs met as well. And she's the one who gets me outside. And if it weren't for her, I wouldn't have the amazing therapeutic medicine that is just being outside and getting fresh air and sweating your worries away and remembering to be here now. That's who I'm grateful for. That keeps reminding me that we need the outdoors and that it's good for mental and emotional and physical health.
What do you think, Willow? Can you tell me?
Tell me.
Good girl.
Reading Sonia's blog, The Pevs Dispenser, I was struck by a recent canyoneering experience she'd had. We often talk about how nature is a cure, but this trip triggered anxiety for her. She shared the story with me.
Basically, what happened is we went canyoneering in Utah near Hanksville. I was just getting started writing. I'm going on this canyoneering trip. I've never even been inside of a canyon. I didn't even know you could go inside of a canyon. I'll write a piece that will be focused on like how to go canyoneering. If you tend to be more anxious or if you're like scared of that sort of thing, here's how you manage the symptoms of anxiety while you're outside. And I didn't expect to get anxious because I don't really get anxious outside. I'm really usually a pretty calm outdoors person. And so I was going into this with like this total confidence of, oh, you know, I'll just like make it through the canyon. I'll like write a quick post about this. And then we got in there and the first thing that happened was we rappelled into the canyon and we pulled down our ropes and we immediately ran into water. And we had not expected that. We expected the canyon to be completely dry. And this was the last weekend in November, I think. And so it was cold and there was water. And the way the canyon was it was narrow enough that we could like push our backs against the back of the canyon and then our, you know, our hands or feet on the other side and sort of like crab walk sideways over the water, which was fine when it was a foot off the ground and there was, you know, a couple inches of water. Like, it wasn't a huge deal. And then it got less fun because the space between where we were and like the water on the bottom started getting higher and higher and people's feet got wet. And then the water was super deep and I didn't have the strength to hold my body up. And I was just like getting really nervous. And it wasn't even like nothing was going to happen if I fell in the water. I was going to get wet. But the anticipation of falling was really intense. So I actually just like took off most of my clothing and I was like in my underwear and my bra and I just walked through the water and it was freezing. And I have a phobia of water. I'm not afraid of anything besides water. And so like walking through this water where I couldn't see the bottom was terrifying for me. That's when it stopped being fun. It was getting dark. We were unprepared as a group to handle what that day was going to turn out to be. There was like one moment when we were stemming, which is what it's called when you like sort of press your body against both sides of the canyon. And I was looking down and there was like 20 feet below me and there was rocks on the bottom. And I knew that like if I fell, it was going to get narrow enough that like my body would get stuck and I would have to sort of climb back out. And I just got like tunnel vision and I couldn't even think straight. I knew my body was probably strong enough, but I couldn't trust it to do anything. And it took like 12 hours. We ultimately got out, but we at some point were rappelling like 100 feet into nothing. Like, we couldn't see anything. And it was totally humbling, you know, because I came into this adventure thinking that it was going to be chill and I was going to write this piece and sort of like wipe my hands and be done with it. And it was a really hard lesson in like, I need to work on managing my anxiety more than I really thought I did, because that had never happened before, or it had never happened that intensely where I stopped being able to function almost altogether. But the funny thing that happened was that towards the end of the canyon, again, I have this phobia of water, and I had been in the back of a group with somebody sort of holding my hand the whole way, and I had allowed myself to be anxious. And then when we were getting to the end, it so happened that I was in the beginning of the group, and I had rappelled into water. And my options were either wait where I was for the next couple people to come into the water and then we would go together, or I could walk forward through 5 feet of water and I don't know what's on the bottom and I don't know what's in front of me, but I had to either go forward or stand by myself in the water. And as soon as there was nobody with me to hold my hand is when I was like, oh, okay, nobody's gonna get me out of this. I have to walk. And I walked through this water. There was just dry earth on the other side, but it took me walking through that water and like going around a corner that I couldn't see to really get over myself. And that's when I was like, okay, I can do this.
The lesson I hear in this, there is a way through, even when you don't know what is around the bend. You can read Sonia's writing on her blog, pevsdispenser.com. That's www.pevsdispenser.com. I'll also list a link on the episode page. So we skimmed the surface today and focused more on anxiety than any other mental health issues. But I have other interviews planned that will go deeper into individual stories. And don't go just yet. I have a mini interview with Jen Gorecki, the founder of Coalition Snow, a company that makes snowboards and skis for women. Jen's going to tell us about her latest Kickstarter. First, I do want to make a quick correction from the last episode, Small Beauty on the Appalachian Trail. I said Rahawa had met just one black person on the trail, but in fact, it was closer to 10. This is an error on my part. I misread an interview. I apologize for any confusion.
It's always a bit stressful. You're really putting yourself out there, right? You're like telling the whole world, we're going to do this thing. But then you know you only are going to be able to do it if you reach your goal. And what if you don't? So there's a lot of that self-doubt and stress. And then there's also like trying to pair that with, we're absolutely going to do this because we did it last time and we're successful. We have the acumen to make this happen. We're going to do it. So just a lot of things swirling around.
This is Jen Gorecki, founder of Coalition Snow. And this is how it all got started.
You hang out with all these women and women just talk about how women's equipment sucks. Why are there rainbows and flowers on these skis? And why are they short? And why are they soft? And when is the industry going to realize that women want something more? I was out on a backcountry ski trip on the east side of the Sierras, and we were having this exact conversation of like, what is it going to take for the industry to actually recognize that we want something different and we want something better? And one of the people in our group said, they're not. For this to happen, someone really needs to take it on and say, we're going to build this company that builds the type of gear that we actually want. And that person looked at me and said, you'd be great to do this, Jen.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Kickstarter that you're running right now?
We have had mothers and fathers and general humans for the last 2 years ask us when we're going to make kids skis and boards because they want the same thing for their girls that we've been offering to women. And we finally pulled the trigger. I mean, as a small company, it's really difficult to introduce new products. Next year will be our fourth year, and we really wanted to be able to meet this demand and support women of all ages. So we did a lot of the prototyping and testing this past winter and realized that really in terms of the funding side of it, the only way that we would be able to make this line available to the public would be through a Kickstarter. So we launched the Kickstarter on International Women's Day, and we're looking to raise $50,000 so that we can build skis and snowboards for girls. And in terms of what makes that equipment different from what's out there currently is we've chosen to use the same high quality materials in our youth line that we do in the women's line. And that's not something that's normally done. But we just believe that families want durability and they want high quality gear. So we're really emphasizing that along with like fun shapes and sizes.
A unique aspect of the Kickstarter is the community aspect. How will you be building community for young women?
You can look at what we're doing with the Park City United team where we sponsored all of those girls. And we didn't necessarily look at it of how many competitions they've been in or did they podium or not. But we said, as a company, we believe in supporting young girls in their path as athletes. That's one way that we feel like we can build community is by supporting these young girls. Like, we really look at how can we support other people who are out there doing that. So we'll look at continuing to sponsor young women, build out our athlete and ambassador team. We this year launched Sisterhood of Shred groups, which are just regional groups of women who come together to go skiing and ride together. And we'll really look at how that can be inclusive for younger girls. And then honestly, one of the ways that we can really help build community is by the other organizations that we support. Coalition doesn't need to come in and recreate the good work that, for example, that She Jumps does or what OWA does. So we look at like how we can be partners with them and support their work because we're all in this together and we're all trying to do the same thing. Partnering with other women in the industry, particularly nonprofits, is one way that we'll be able to carry this forward long after the Kickstarter.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
One of the things for us is that we understand that not everybody has a child or not everybody might be interested in the youth line, but the Kickstarter means a lot more. It's a way for people to support female founders and to support women in business. And we live in a really interesting time right now in the United States where we're seeing women have a voice and have a role both politically and socially that in my 40 years, I don't know if I've ever seen. And so we really feel like we're contributing to a movement of women who are creating their own rules, calling their own shots, and really being role models and mentors to younger girls, whether or not they ever decide to ski or board. And the Kickstarter for us it can be really difficult to be a woman in business. And there's so much data that supports a lot of the biases that exist. And what we love about the Kickstarter is that it's a way to really democratize business and sort of level the playing field, where it doesn't matter if you went to that Ivy League school or to business school, or if you come from incredible privilege. What crowdfunding does is it takes your idea or it takes your product or service and opens it up to the world. It's not just about planks of wood for us. This is really a much bigger movement around how you support women and how you contribute to the things that make our society a better place for girls and women alike.
As I'm reading this, Coalition Snow is $2,500 away from their goal. The Kickstarter ends on Friday, April 7th at 9 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at www.coalitionsnow.com. Big thanks to our sponsor, Oru Kayak. It takes a lot of work to make a podcast, and the right sponsors make a really big difference. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be so great if you could write a review on iTunes or subscribe to our newsletter. Music in this episode is by Sro, Kai Engel, Mind's Eye, Rocco W., and Lee Rosevier. Until next time, bye.